Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science or the people yielding it failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and tries to see the human story behind the numbers. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today, we are discussing Dennis Rader, the BTK killer. I've mentioned him a couple of times now. First in my episode about DNA profiling, and then last week when we were discussing genetic DNA investigations. He is a serial killer. He is a predator. And yes, I consider the man to be an absolute idiot, because he was captured due to his own ego. This wasn't Gacy or Dahmer being overwhelmed by the sheer thrill of what they were doing. He had covered his tracks. He'd gotten away with it. He had been silent for all those years. But he wanted to brag about it, boast about how he had gotten away with everything. However, while he had been living a normal life, science had not been stagnant. He was an analog killer who didn't realize he was now living in a high-resolution world. He assumed that because he had stopped his projects in 1991, the trail had gone cold. He was wrong. He didn't realize that while he was settling into a quiet life of city ordinances and church meetings, forensic science had spent those 13 years sharpening its tools. He was still playing by 1970s rules, but the laboratory had moved into a completely different era of detection. To understand how this case eventually collided with modern science, you have to go back to a Tuesday morning in Wichita, January 15th, 1974. It was a cold, unremarkable winter day until a young boy came home from school and found that his house had turned into a nightmare. When the first responding officers stepped into the Otero home in 1974, they weren't stepping into a high-tech forensic environment. They were walking into a crime scene that, by today's laboratory standards, would look terrifyingly unprotected. They were working with the manual analog tools of the era. Fingerprinting dust, basic 35mm photography, and the limited biological metrics of the mid-70s, where ABO stereotyping was the standard. What they found was a scene of clinical, calculated brutality. Joseph and Julie Otero, along with two of their children, Josephine and Joseph Jr., had been murdered in a way that suggested a predator obsessed with physical control. The house wasn't a mess of random violence, it was a display of technical precision. The predator had used cords and blinds, mundane household items found right there in the home, to bind his victims. He left behind a physical signature of ligature and knots that showed a high degree of manual ritual. In 1974, this was a behavioral clue, but it wasn't a biological ID. The most haunting image of that morning, the one that would sit in the files for 30 years, was 11-year-old Josephine. She hadn't just been killed. She had been put on display in the basement. She was found partially clothed, hanging from a water pipe, a victim of a ritual that the investigators of the time didn't even have a name for yet. It was a level of depravity that felt out of place in a quiet Kansas neighborhood. In the 1970s forensic lab, the biological evidence was a blunt instrument. Technicians found biological crumbs, semen, and hair. The science was decades away from being able to sequence a genome. They were limited to the previously mentioned ABO blood typing. The lab confirmed the suspect was type A, a result that narrowed the pool down to about 40% of the male population in Kansas. Unless he left a perfect fingerprint on a non-porous surface, the person who did this was just another anonymous data point in a sea of millions. What they didn't find was a motive that fit the patterns of the time. There was no theft of high-value items and no clear personal connection. The murderer had entered the home like a ghost and left the same way, leaving behind a broad, generic signature that the science of the time simply couldn't resolve into a name. The Otero family turned out to be just the beginning of a growing trauma for the city. Over the next 17 years, this same shadow continued to cross the lives of his neighbors, expanding a morbid portfolio with a series of murders that the public and the police struggled to link together. Just months after the Oteros, Catherine Bright was stabbed to death. In 1977, he murdered Shirley Vian and Nancy Fox. Shirley was strangled in her own bed while her children were forced into a bathroom, trapped behind a door while their mother was being killed just a few feet away. These were the years where the taunting letters began arriving at a local news desk. Letters where a killer demanded recognition for his work, and eventually provided his own moniker, BTK. By the mid-80s, he had murdered Maureen Hedge, and Vicky Wergely, and finally Dolores Davis in 1991. In each of these scenes, the killer left pieces of himself, hairs, fibers, and biological stains. In the 70s and 80s, these were just clutter in an evidence locker. Investigators were doing their best to maintain the chain of custody, placing items into paper bags and filing them away in climate-controlled storage. They didn't know it at the time, but they were essentially creating a molecular time capsule. While the detectives of the 70s were frustrated by the lack of type A leads, they were following the routine, administrative standard of evidence storage, putting the samples in the right boxes at the right temperature and logging them into the system. They were preserving a biological record that they couldn't even read yet, ensuring that his identity stayed physically present in the building while the man himself walked free. And then, in 1991, the signal went dark. The murder stopped. To understand Dennis Rader, you have to understand a man obsessed with the mechanics of control. Born in 1945 in Wichita, Kansas, Rader's early life wasn't a story of trauma, but of rigid Midwestern conformity. He was the eldest of four boys in a blue-collar family, a Boy Scout, and a member of the local Lutheran church. But even as a child, he was already developing what he called Dr. X, a detached internal drive to dominate. As he grew up, while he was graduating high school and joining the U.S. Air Force, he was quietly documenting his own dark fantasies with the precision of a technical manual, essentially drafting the SOPs for a life he hadn't yet begun. When he returned to Wichita in 1970, after 4 years of military discipline, he began building the life of the ultimate institutional man. He was the personification of the safe suburban father. And he had also earned a degree in the administration of justice, becoming a literal student of the systems designed to catch predators like him. He understood the standard of 1970s forensics. He knew about fingerprinting and the limitations of blood typing. He didn't just want to live in society. He wanted to be the one who managed its rules and live by his own. This need for authority and power manifested in his career, from being a supervisor in the U.S. Census Bureau to his long-standing role as a compliance officer in Park City. These roles gave him the perfect professional mask to map out the city and observe his neighbors under the guise of official data collection, all the while building and hiding behind an impenetrable mask. To his neighbors, he was the man who measured the height of their grass and issued citations for loose dogs. For his community, he was the president of the church council and a leader of the Cub Scouts. But while he was enforcing city ordinances by day, he was hunting by night. Between 1974 and 1991, Rader murdered 10 people. He didn't just kill, he curated. He treated his victims as projects, documenting the details of their deaths in folders he kept hidden in his office, organized with the same administrative rigor he used for his city records. He was a monster. He did terrible things. But he had this image of himself as this legendary apex predator, while in his day-to-day life, he was actually just a petty bureaucrat obsessing over lawn maintenance. He loved the authority of his clipboard and the standards of the ordinances because it was the only way he could feel the power he pretended to have in his project folders. He craved control. He craved attention. He wanted to be recognized as the legend he was in his own mind. He began sending taunting letters to the media, demanding recognition of his perceived superiority, and coining his own moniker, BTK. He wanted the world to see the how and why of his power, but he also wanted to remain the man behind the compliance badge in his safe suburban bubble. He was a master of psychological compartmentalization, capable of leading a scout meeting in the afternoon and executing a project in the evening. He kept his dirty fantasies and his clean public life in two strictly separated labs. And then, in 1991, he stopped. He didn't stop because he was caught, and he didn't stop because he felt remorse. He stopped because the persona he had hid behind had become his reality. For the next 13 years, the BTK signal went dark. The compliance officer, the church leader, and the father were no longer just parts he was playing. They were the only things left on the surface. He had become a fixture of his community. A man so synonymous with order that no one could see the biological predator buried beneath the suburban lawn Nazi. He lived in the silence, letting the world believe that BTK was a ghost, while he settled into the comfort of his own meticulously maintained standard. He stopped killing, and the mask became his reality. For 13 years, Dennis Rader lived in a state of total domestic immersion. In Park City, he didn't actually hold authority, but he became the appearance standard for the neighborhood. He was the pious church leader, the dedicated Boy Scout mentor, a perfectly calibrated Stepford mask of suburban virtue. He wasn't an actual pillar of the community. He was the performance of one. He spent his days enforcing the correct way to live, ensuring that every lawn was trimmed and every dog was leashed, while he himself was the thing out of alignment. He used the mundane rules of society to hide in plain sight, becoming a man so synonymous with order that no one could see the predator buried behind the suburban performance. By the time he was elected president of Christ Lutheran Church, his role play had ceased to be a cover and became a deep personal investment in a social hierarchy that respected him. He was raising two children who had no inkling that factor X was even a variable in their home. But while his public life was completely orderly, his private world was a static, unventilated archive. Tucked away in his office and secreted under floorboards were his project folders. He wasn't actively killing, but he was fantasizing. He was reliving. He kept a physical inventory of his crimes, Polaroids, driver's licenses, and jewelry, organized with the chilling precision of a morbid laboratory logbook. He was a cosplayer who was blurring the lines between which personality was real and which was a role. This was his stagnation. While Rader was frozen in this 1991 mindset, however, the forensic world was moving through a series of massive technological shifts. In his mind, he was invisible because he had mastered the limitations of forensics in 1974. In 1974, if you didn't leave a fingerprint, you were biologically anonymous. To a man like Rader, being one of millions of type A men in Kansas wasn't a clue. It was a permanent shield of anonymity. But by the time he hit his hiatus in 1991, the technology was beginning to shift. DNA testing was starting to become an integral part of the forensic landscape. But it remained cumbersome. RFLP, or Restriction Fragment Length Polymorphism, the standard at the time, was a slow process and required large, pristine samples of biological fluid to create a DNA profile. So, even if he understood this, Rader's sense of security was built on the arrogant obsession of obsolescence. He believed his project files and the evidence from the 70s were now just harmless paper and dried waste. He assumed the shelf life of his crimes had expired because, in his era, the technology required a fresh, heavy trail that he simply wasn't leaving anymore. What he failed to understand is that while he was busy enforcing city ordinances, the lab had moved into the era of PCR, or polymerase chain reaction, and STR, or short tandem repeat mapping. In the world of laboratory science, PCR was a total technological pivot. It allowed us to take a shattered microscopic fragment of DNA, the kind of biological crumbs Rader had left at the Otero house in 1974, and amplify it. We no longer needed a huge wet sample or a visible stain. We can now copy a single degraded strand of DNA millions of times until it was large enough to be sequenced and digitized. Science didn't need a fresh trail, it just needed a ghost of a left-behind cell. Radio was an analog predator who believed his intellect made him an invisible specter. He didn't realize that while he settled into the comfort of his own meticulously maintained world, laboratories around the world had spent 13 years developing the capacity to extract his identity from evidence he thought had already rotted away. He woke up in 2004 thinking he was still playing a game of hide-and-seek by 1970s rules, never realizing that the technology had fundamentally changed the game while he was hiding in the backyard. The breaking point in Vader's facade wasn't a lapse in his domestic life or a crack in his compliance badge. It was a surge of ego that finally compromised his own containment. In January 2004, the 30th anniversary of the Otero family murders brought his first project back into the headlines. The media wasn't looking for a man in the suburbs. They were discussing a ghost. Local speculation suggested that BTK was either dead, long gone, or perhaps rotting in a prison cell for some unrelated crime. To an ego like Raiders, being a closed file was a professional insult. He had spent decades curating his own dark history, and he wasn't about to let the world write the final analysis without his input. So, when local author Robert Beatty announced he was writing a book to finally solve the mystery, Rader hit a wall. He didn't want to be inspiration for a mystery. He wanted to be the primary source. He felt a pathological need to correct the record and reclaim the narrative of his own atrocities. This was his digital disconnect. He decided to reemerge from his sanctuary and claim his glory, but he was making a fatal analytical error. He believed the rules of the game were the same ones he had mastered in the 70s and 80s. He was still playing by analog rules in a world that had moved into high-resolution surveillance and data recovery. So, in March 2004, Rader decided to end his 13 years of silence. He stopped being a shadow and started providing the police with a verifiable trail. He sent a letter to the Wichita Eagle that functioned as a biological proof of life. Inside was a copy of Vicky Wiggerly's driver's license, a trophy from the 1986 murder that the public hadn't even fully linked to BTK yet. With this letter, Rader adopted a new persona. He wasn't just a killer returning to the hunt. He was acting as a historical consultant on his own crimes. He broke his silence because the institutional mask had been too successful. He was so well hidden, so synonymous with the mundane, that the world had forgotten to be afraid of him. He stepped out of the shadows not to resume the violence, but to ensure his legacy was properly documented. He wanted to make sure that when the final report on BTK was written, his own voice was the one providing the facts. In 2004, Rader wasn't even hunting anymore, not for victims. He was looking for a spotlight. Over the next 11 months, he sent 11 separate packages to the police and local media, treating the investigation like his own personal press tour. He wasn't just taunting. He was feeding them clues like he was a retired professor testing a group of slow students. He included jewelry from his victims, detailed project drawings, even word search puzzles. He was a bored administrator seeking professional validation, literally assisting the investigators while operating under the smug delusion that they were fundamentally incapable of catching him. He couldn't stand the idea of a world where his name wasn't synonymous with fear, or where he might be forgotten in the mundane humdrum of city ordinances and church potlucks. He wanted the headlines, the book deals, the HBO specials. He wanted the recognition for the work he had done. The detectives might not have had a name yet, but they were starting to see a pattern that looked less like a criminal mastermind and more like a rigid middle manager. This was his behavioral signature. Behavioral analysis, saw an obsession with rules and specific linguistic patterns that Rader simply couldn't turn off. He was drafting his own profile through his inability to deviate from his own internal standard. Every clue he dropped was a crumb of his own bureaucracy. Then came the moment his hubris finally bypassed his survival instinct. He decided he wanted to send larger volumes of data, more lessons, more projects, but without the risk of a postmark or leaving a biological trace on a stamp. So, he treated the investigation as a feasibility study of his own safety. He actually reached out to the police and asked, "Can I communicate via floppy disk without being traced? Be honest." He wasn't just being careful, he was asking for permission to keep playing the game. And the police did what any good investigator does when handed a gift. They lied. They acted like his confidants. They placed a newspaper ad addressed to his code name, Rex, it'll be okay. Dennis believed them. He believed that he had cleared the protocol for secure communication. So, Rader sent a 1.4 megabyte purple Memorex floppy disk to a local TV station. He thought he was being clever, but he was an analog man who didn't realize he was standing in a high-resolution spotlight. In the lab, we think of metadata as the burn book of digital files. It's the stuff the file says about you behind your back. When Rader deleted a file that was on the disk, he thought he was wiping it clean. But in digital forensics, deleting a file is like throwing a contaminated sample away in a biohazard bin without also bleaching the counter that you were working on. The traces are still there. You've just told the computer it's okay to work around and over it. Investigators used a bitstream image to recover the deleted sectors of that gifted purple disk, and they found the remnants of a Microsoft Word document. The deleted file wasn't just evidence of a name, it was a timestamp of his own arrogance. The metadata showed the file had been created at Christ Lutheran Church and last modified by a user named Dennis. For a man who obsessed over his projects, he failed to realize that every digital action leaves a calculated footprint. He was caught by the very administrative tools he used to keep his life clean. This metadata gave the police a starting coordinate, Christ Lutheran Church. They quickly discovered a Dennis who served as the church council president. He drove a black Jeep Cherokee, the same make of vehicle spotted in surveillance footage at a previous BTK drop site. They immediately began a tight surveillance on this Park City compliance officer. They watched him go about his mundane, orderly life. But here's the thing. They had the digital gossip, but they didn't have the proof. They knew it was him, but they couldn't exactly walk into a church council meeting and arrest the president based on a deleted Word document and a common SUV. They had the name Dennis written in the metadata, but they didn't have the biological receipts to link him to the 1974 crimes. The police were stuck in a classic diagnostic limbo. They had uncovered the hidden signature from the Christ Lutheran Church metadata, But in a world of forensics, the name on a Word doc is just circumstantial noise. To make an arrest stick to a pillar of the community, they needed biological receipts. They needed a DNA profile from the 1974 Otero crime scene to perfectly overlay a sample from the man in the black Jeep. Rader wasn't making it easy. It wasn't that he was a criminal mastermind pulling counter-surveillance moves. He was just a fussy, fastidious man who didn't leave a mess. He wasn't tossing cigarette butts or soda cans out his car window for detectives to scoop up. He was the kind of guy who probably emptied his lint trap and double-bagged his trash to maintain his orderly world. He was so convinced the police were still chasing a ghost from the 70s that he never even considered that he was under a microscope. The investigators realized they couldn't wait for a lucky break from a man this tidy. They needed to bypass Rader's personal hygiene and go for a surgical strike through his lineage. Since they couldn't get to Dennis, they went for the next best thing in the genetic database: his daughter. The reason Rader was so calm during this period, the reason he was still measuring lawns and acting as the neighborhood's moral compass, was a massive systemic error. He was operating on a 1974 mental map, trapped in a loop of process stagnation. In his head, the evidence he left behind at the Otero house 3 decades earlier was biologically expired. He genuinely believed that if a technique didn't exist when he started, it couldn't be used to finish him. He treated the evolution of forensics as a suggestion rather than a reality. He was still stuck in the world of ABO blood typing, where science was a blunt instrument that could only narrow a suspect pool down to a broad, anonymous group. He didn't account for the fact that while he was busy being a pillar of the community, the lab had developed the ability to resolve a single microscopic skin cell into a digital barcode. This wasn't just a technology gap, it was a total conceptual failure. The belief that the standard is a static thing you can hide behind forever. He genuinely seemed to believe that after 30 years, DNA either broke down into useless noise or hit some kind of legal statute of limitations. However, police were still hitting a hard stop. They had the digital gossip from the church floppy disk, but they lacked a direct comparison between Rader and the evidence he had left behind at the crime scenes. Because Rader appeared to be a law-abiding compliance officer with no prior felony convictions, his DNA simply didn't exist in the CODIS database. He was a clean sample in a system designed to flag dirty ones. Detectives followed him everywhere: Home Depot, local diners, waiting for him to slip up. But as we know, Rader was a fussy neat freak. He didn't toss coffee cups in public bins or leave cigarette butts on the sidewalk. He wasn't being meticulous to avoid a DNA match. He didn't think he was a suspect. And he certainly didn't think the police were standing by with a high-resolution spotlight while he was still playing hide-and-seek in the dark. So, the investigation made a tactical pivot. If they couldn't get a sample from Dennis, they would go for what he had passed on. They identified a systemic vulnerability in his daughter, Carrie, who was a student at Kansas State University. Even then, the investigators bypassed her person entirely and went looking through her medical records. They discovered that she had a routine pap smear in the archives at the University Medical Center. In my MLS world, a cytology slide is a routine diagnostic tool for cancer screening, not a forensic evidence kit. But to the police, that slide was a genetic goldmine. When they returned to the lab bench, it wasn't about directly outsmarting Rader, it was about kinship math. Technicians had to isolate the epithelial cells from that clinical slide and extract the DNA to build a profile for Carrie. They weren't looking for a 100% match to the Otero crime scene. They were looking for a familial half signal. When the lab compared that 1974 dirty sample to Carrie's clean clinical sample, the math was absolute. The DNA from the Otero family murders belonged to the biological father of the woman who had provided that pap smear. The institutional man was finally out-administered by his own biology. Finally, on February 25th, 2005, Dennis Rader was just a man in a black 1998 Jeep Cherokee driving home for a midday break. There was no cinematic shootout, no high-speed chase, and no dramatic standoff. He was simply driving home for lunch when the police stopped him. For a man who lived by the clock and the code, it was a completely unremarkable thing. He wasn't a supervillain being cornered. He was just a city employee being removed from the road on a Tuesday morning. When the lights initially went on behind him, Rader didn't see the end of a 30-year-old secret. He saw a nuisance. To Rader, the law was a tool he used to monitor others. He likely viewed the police as peers in the business of compliance. He didn't realize that while he was maintaining his own standard of suburban order, the justice system had finally synchronized its gears against him. This wasn't a random patrol stop. It was the quiet culmination of a multi-point plan. The police weren't guessing. They were executing a stack of signed search warrants for his person, his vehicle, his home on Independence Street, even his desk at Park City Hall. They waited for him to be in the most vulnerable, mundane position possible. Isolated behind the wheel of his SUV. As the officers approached the window, Rader didn't look like a man whose double life had just imploded. He was reportedly cooperative, almost helpful, acting with the same detached, professional air he used when he was the one doing the enforcing. He didn't realize that while he sat in the driver's seat, separate teams were already entering his home and his office. The mask had already been stripped away and the scene illuminated. The police weren't just arresting a man, they were taking possession of his records. They were gathering the boxes, the files, and the physical trophies he had kept since 1974. It wasn't a dramatic bust. It was the filing of a return on warrant and the quiet, heavy click of a pair of handcuffs. Simple and procedural. The real shift in tone happened once Rader was in the interrogation room. It wasn't just a relocation. It was a total recalibration of reality. Yet, when Rader sat across from the detectives, he didn't behave like a cornered animal. He behaved like a manager who had been caught in a minor audit. Rader wasn't crying or begging for mercy. He was indignant. His primary grievance wasn't the decades of life he destroyed. It was the fact that the police had lied to him about that floppy disk. He felt the rules of the game had been violated. In Rader's mind, he had reached out to the police as a peer, asking for a technical consultation on the traceability of digital media. When the police lied and told him that the disk was safe, he saw it as a breach of professional etiquette. To Rader, the investigation was a negotiation, and he felt the police had committed a technical foul. He was more upset about the dishonesty of the investigators than he was about the reality of the 10 murders he was about to describe. When he finally sat down to give his confession, the mean girl edge we saw in his letters flattened into the voice of a detached, mid-level bureaucrat. In court, he didn't describe human beings. He described projects. He spoke about 10 murders with the flat, professional delivery of a city official giving a quarterly report on property taxes. He was a man who had spent 30 years organizing his atrocities with the precision of a laboratory record. When the police finally executed the search warrants on his home and office, they found the physical metadata of his double life, tucked away like a morbid archive were his project folders, thousands of pages of sketches, Polaroids, and stolen trophies, all filed and categorized. He had been a meticulous curator of his own crimes, never realizing that the more data he collected, the more he was anchoring himself to the results. In the end, Rader was undone by the two pillars of his mundane existence. The first pillar to crumble was his social identity, the administrative role he had at Christ Lutheran Church, the very place he used to anchor his reputation, betrayed him through that floppy disk. Rader thought he was being a mentor to the police by using a disk, but he was actually handing them a metadata coordinate to his front door. The very institution he used to hide his character was the one that provided the name that finally stuck to the ghost they'd been chasing since 1974. The second pillar was his family, which Rader treated as the ultimate proof of his normalcy. He believed that because he was a husband and a father with no criminal record, he was biologically invisible to the system. He didn't realize that your DNA isn't just your own. It's a shared record. When the police couldn't get a sample from him because of his fussy, neat-freak habits, they simply went around him. They used a clandestine subpoena to pull a routine pap smear slide belonging to his daughter, Carrie, from a university medical clinic. In a pathology lab, this slide was, you know, just a standard tool for cancer screening. But for the investigators, it was a genetic backup of the killer's biological signature. By running a familial DNA test, they didn't need a direct sample from Dennis. They just needed the 50% match from his daughter to prove that the man who fathered her was the same man who had left biological evidence at the Otero crime scene 30 years prior. Rader was a man who thought he had compartmentalized his life perfectly. He thought his project files were separate from his Sunday morning church bulletins and separate from his daughter's medical history. In the end, the system didn't need to outsmart him. He was simply identified by the routine, everyday data generated by the life he tried so hard to pretend was real. It's a strange clinical reality. For 30 years, Rader thought he was in control just because he was completely ignorant of the world he actually lived in. He assumed the trace he left behind was limited to what he could see. Physical footprints or blood types from 1974. He didn't realize that while he was busy filing his projects, forensic science had moved into a world of DNA sequencing he didn't even know existed. He wasn't outsmarted by a detective's hunch. He was identified by the routine, everyday work of forensic scientists and a pathology lab. We began this story in a basement in 1974 with a scene so depraved it felt like it belonged to a ghost. For 30 years, Josephine Otero was a haunting image in a cold file. But because those first responding officers followed the standard, because they didn't let those biological crumbs rot, the ghost eventually met the machine. Dennis thought he was a ghost, but he was actually just a slow-moving biological record in a world that had gone digital. The nightmare that started on a cold Tuesday in January didn't end because the killer grew a conscience. It ended because the molecular time capsule finally opened, and science was ready to read the name inside. In the end, Dennis Rader wasn't undone by a lapse in his domestic mask or a smudge on his compliance badge. He was dismantled by the very administrative systems he spent his life pretending to protect. He treated the police like a group of slow students, never realizing that while he was busy acting as a historical consultant for his own crimes, the forensic world had moved into a level of precision he couldn't comprehend. He was taunting a justice system he thought he had mastered, but the rules of the game had been rewritten while he was looking the other way. He was an analog predator who believed his own shadow was a shield, while the world had a high-resolution revolution. His church provided the digital fingerprint, his daughter provided the biological one. He wasn't the invisible specter he believed himself to be. He was a man whose identity had been archived by the very life he used as a cover. Dennis wanted to be the one who wrote the final report on BTK, securing his legacy. Dennis Rader wanted to be the one who defined the standard. He thought he was the ultimate auditor of his own life, never realizing that the world doesn't stay static. He was an analog predator caught in a high-resolution trap, but the final report wasn't found in his project folders or his taunting letters. It was written on a pathology slide and on a digital server. He thought he was a ghost, only to be identified by the mundane, everyday data generated by the very life he tried so hard to pretend was real. He wasn't undone by a single mistake. He was dismantled by a systemic evolution. In the end, the ghost didn't vanish into the night. He was archived, sequenced, and identified by the routine, everyday data of the very life he used as a mask. It wasn't a cinematic ending. It was a successful laboratory audit. So, next week, we're doing something a bit different. As we move into my birthday month, I'm leaning into some of my absolute favorite topics in the world of science, forensics, and true crime. We're going to be talking about crime, investigations, and forensics in fiction. This is going to be a two-part deep dive because there is just so much to cover. We're going to talk about the icons that I fangirl, from the forensic precision of Patricia Cornwell's case Garbetta, including her real-life influences and the upcoming TV series, to the anthropology of Kathy Reichs and Jefferson Bass. And we'll be spending some time with Agatha Christie, who is a personal star in this world, and of course, a mention or two of Sherlock Holmes. These are the stories that make science feel personal, and I can't wait to share my favorites with you. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. If you found today's deep dive into the chemistry of death and history of profiling and catching people who need to be caught fascinating, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. Reviews help the other science-minded true crime fans find the show, so I encourage you to tell your accomplices. I mean friends, to learn along with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on these cases or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and join us in our next episode.